welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C. Britain coronate King Charles III Saturday. We'll have the latest development.
We've just seen King Charles III and Queen Consort Camilla crowned inside Westminster Abbey in an extraordinary show of British pomp and pageantry that stretches back centuries.
The Electoral Commission of Sierra Leone approves the nomination of President Julius Maada Bio and his main rival Samora Camara.
We've completed the nomination process for the paramount chief members of parliament. You know, in our parliament, we have two sets of representation. That are completed.
And the Uganda Law Society warns that it will launch lawsuits against police officers who use excessive force and brutality against peaceful protesters. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Britain, the resplendent coronation ceremony for King Charles III has ended in Westminster Abbey. It is the first British coronation spectacular in 70 years. Queen Elizabeth II was the last British monarch to be crowned. The 74-year-old Charles became king the moment his mother died in September. Thousands of people wearing red, white and blue, the colours of the British flag, and others with paper crowns atop their heads lined the streets of London Saturday. They cheered Charles and Queen Consort Camilla as they made their way to the coronation in the modern Diamond Jubilee coach. For the latest development, I reach colleague and viewer Europe correspondent Henry Ridgewell in London.
Well, we've just seen King Charles III and Queen Consort Camilla crowned inside Westminster Abbey in an extraordinary show of British pomp and pageantry that stretches back centuries. It's an echo of the first coronation ceremony that took place in Westminster Abbey in 1066, the crowning of William the Conqueror. And practically every single coronation of the monarch has taken place in a similar way since then. And many of the rituals, the traditions that took place during the ceremony stretch back that far. There were several Christian aspects to the ceremony. King Charles is a very religious man. He was anointed with holy oil brought from Jerusalem. The procession cross included fragments of what's said to be the true cross upon which Jesus was crucified that were gifted by Pope Francis to the monarchy. So some deeply religious elements, but some important constitutional elements as well for the British leader and the crown. And once the ceremony was finished, the king and queen led the procession out of the abbey and got into the gold state carriage. Now, that was built in the 1800s, an incredibly ornate carriage that has carried many of the monarchs from the coronation procession. Famously uncomfortable as well. It's got very little suspension, so it will be a rough ride.
Harry, after this official ceremony, what's next?
Well, the King and Queen will return to Buckingham Palace. The procession will take around an hour or more because the carriage is so heavy. It is pulled by eight horses, but it can only go at walking pace because of its weight. So it will be around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, London time, when the King and Queen arrive back at the palace. They are then shortly expected on the balcony of the palace, that famous balcony where so many important moments in the history of the royal family have been witnessed. They will wave to the hundreds of thousands of people gathered outside. There is supposed to be a flypast of modern and old aircraft from the RAF, from the Royal Air Force, across central London and over the palace. To greet them. But unfortunately, the weather is not good. It has been raining all morning, and we're waiting to find out whether that flypast will have to be cancelled because of low clouds. So the weather has rather put a dampener on things, but the hundreds of thousands of people, many of whom have been camped out for several days, are determined to have a good time. They're enjoying the ceremony, enjoying witnessing a piece of history.
What is the atmosphere like in London where this is taking place, especially with the rain? As some people say, it's a blessing, others are saying. It's dampened what is going on, but has it thwarted the enthusiasm that people had watching this unfold?
On a sunny day, you might have a sea of people enjoying picnics and enjoying the sunshine. Today, really, it's a sea of umbrellas as people shelter from the rain. But interestingly, it was exactly the same weather in 1953 when King Charles's mother, Queen Elizabeth II, was crowned as well. So perhaps it will bring longevity and luck for the monarch. But people are out in force in the streets of London, not only on the route of the procession itself, where they're desperate to get a glimpse of the procession of the King and Queen, but also more generally out celebrating. It is a holiday weekend. There's an extra bank holiday, a holiday day on Monday. So people are out celebrating in pubs, in parks, around people's houses, not just today, but in the coming days as well, as they mark this important moment in the country's history.
What are people telling you after mingling with them as they watch history unfold?
They very much want to be part of the day, and I think also they want to be part of the crowd as well, the people on the streets of London. It takes, I think, a special type of person to get up early in the morning. Many of these people have travelled a long way, perhaps hundreds of miles, to come into the capital to be here, to wait in a crowd. It's not too comfortable. It's wet. It's fairly cold. There's not too much to eat or drink around. So you have to be prepared and you have to be dedicated to the cause. And I think those people, it reveals that there's still a very strong streak of royalism, of admiration and adoration for the royal family in this country. And if you speak to them, they will talk about their respect for the royal family, their respect for Charles and Camilla, how their reign is evolving. Of course, it was a difficult time for the country when Queen Elizabeth II died last September. And I was on the streets of London covering the same beat at that time as people were mourning the loss of a queen. So it's a very different mood this time. It's a celebratory mood. It's a sign of respect, of wanting to be part of a special day, but also being among a crowd that's just out to have a good time.
Harry Ridgewell in London is VOA's Europe correspondent. He spoke with me from the British capital, London. The Electoral Commission of Sierra Leone has approved the nomination of incumbent President Julius Maada Bio and his main rival, former Foreign Minister Samora Camara, as candidates for president in the June 24 elections. President Maada Bio will lead the ruling Sierra Leone People's Party, or SLPP, while Samora Camara leads the main opposition All People's Congress, APC. The two candidates also vied to lead the country in the last election 5 years ago. Some expect Camara to be a tough competitor for Bio, who is seeking his second and final five-year term. But others say recent opposition endorsements for the president, coupled with the power of incumbency, will make it difficult for the opposition leader to win. For the latest election-related development, I reach Raymond George. He is the spokesperson for the country's Electoral Commission.
Currently, we've completed the nomination process for the Paramount Chief Members of Parliament. You know, in our parliament, we have two sets of representation. That has completed, and we have eight. This week, where candidates have gone unopposed because we have only one candidate that returned after the nomination process. And we'll be going into election for six of those 14 districts. Now, we also completed the nomination process for the local councils. It started on the 19th of April and ended on the 29th of April. It was scheduled to have ended on the 28th, but we had to extend one day because of technical issues in the online nomination process.
Raymond, what about the presidential nomination, the latest development?
The nomination for presidential started on the 30th of April, and it's ongoing. As of today, we are expecting one candidate from Peace and Liberation Party, PLP, to come up for nomination. And in the past days, we've got the All People's Congress, Dr. Samora Wesingkamara, that has gone through the nomination. On day two, we had the President, His Excellency Julius Maada Bio for the SLPP, has gone through the process. Yesterday, we had two. We had the UDM party, and we also have the PDP, People's Democratic Party. So as I speak, there are four, and we're expecting one to come up again today. But the process will go on until the 9th of May. It's ongoing.
When will official campaigning begin after this nomination process?
The campaigns for local government, ordinary members of parliament, and presidential is to commence on the 23rd of May, 2023. And it is to end on the 22nd of June, 2023. The 23rd of June, we'll be having a cooling off period, and on the 24th, we'll have the election. So it will officially start on the 23rd of May.
Well, Raymond, what do you say to those who are of the view that some of the leading political parties are campaigning, but they are saying they've found a clever way of going round and they are reaching out to their supporters, albeit in a Nicodemus campaign strategy? How do you respond to that?
We are aware that such is going on under the name of sensitization. But actually, for us as the commission, we don't regulate the activities of the political parties. We have not officially declared campaign, and that should be the concern for the Political Parties Regulation Commission and the ONS or the SLP. So that is what, and let us also don't forget that the democratic process must be followed right down to even the selection of candidates. So they were using posters to actually sell themselves so that the members in their constituency, in the political parties in the districts, would actually vote for them to become endorsed candidates. But if they are campaigning, that is the that falls under the purview of the SLP and the Political Parties Regulations Commission.
How smooth has this process gone so far with the nomination of parliamentarians and presidential candidates so far? And what have you encountered any challenges that you've resolved so far by the Electoral Commission?
Oh, yes, it has been smooth. It has been going on well. We have the online nomination process put in place this time around. Political parties send their endorsed list online. And what happened was that we provided training for them at the Brookfields Hotel. They brought in their IT experts, and they were trained into how to log into the system and how to operate, how to send in their endorsed list and how to endorse those lists. Remember, there is a law which states that the chairman and leader of the political party and the secretary general must be signatories to the list before the commission will accept them. And also we have the Section 58, which states that 58 and its subsections, which one of them is that every three candidates, one must be a woman. And if that is not met, the commission will reject the list. So we ensure that one is also catered for within the system. And we also have other technical issues. Like, for example, if you want to go in for ordinary member of parliament, you must be registered in anywhere within the country, but your nominators must be registered within the district where you want to contest.
Raymond George is the spokesperson for the Electoral Commission for Sierra Leone. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. The Uganda Law Society is warning that it will launch lawsuits against police officers who used excessive force and brutality against peaceful protesters. Bernard Undu, the president of the Law Association, says the police can be held individually responsible for torture. The remarks come after civil society and opposition groups condemned the police for using what they say is violence to prevent meetings, lawful assembly and protests. Law Society President Bernard Undu tells me that the police and other security services can be held liable for using excessive violence against citizens.
Two important points need to be made here. One is that the freedom of assembly and the freedom to demonstrate is guaranteed under the Constitution. And as long as the citizens are peaceful, are unarmed, they are guaranteed the right to demonstrate under the Constitution. Now, we've had a couple of instances where the police has stopped demonstrations, and in our view, that is unconstitutional and illegal. And the courts, especially the constitutional courts, have been very clear on the right to demonstrate and the right to freedom of assembly. And our laws too, Peter, is that the Human Rights Enforcement Act allows those who violate human rights to be sued personally. And therefore we have warned the Uganda police that if they continue to violate the right to assembly, which is constitutionally protected, will not hesitate to use the Human Rights Enforcement Act to sue them personally.
How yes. feasible is this? And won't it create chaos in the police service were you to go after individual police officers for excessive use of force?
Our role as the Uganda Law Society is to take a matter so that we can have a precedent on the use of the Human Rights Enforcement Act. We believe that once we exercise the rights under the Human Rights Enforcement Act, others will learn and they will understand that the acts that they undertake, some as police officers, they can be held individually.
But Bernard, what do you say to those who are of the view that police officers take orders from above them and that by going after them, it will create what they call insubordination and perhaps dismissal of police officers for disobeying orders when they are asked to go and carry out or stop demonstrations and all that? Why don't you go after, they said, the commanding officers who gave the order?
Yes, what we hope to do in our suit, if we decide to undertake the suit, is that even through the suit, we can establish what we call the command superior responsibility. So the police officers can have as a defense that they are carrying out orders which were being instructed by their superiors. And under that, we will also then be able to take out summons against the superiors and also have action against the superiors. But before you take up what we call under the principle of command superior responsibility, you need to understand who was giving the instructions. Without you knowing who was giving the instructions, it becomes difficult for you to be able to understand how you able to take up the person who was responsible.
Bernard, try to explain to this to an ordinary Ugandan whether this would even be heard by the court, especially when the Constitution mandates the police to maintain law and order.
So Peter, this is the interpretation of the Constitution. The police has a right to maintain law and order, but in terms of assemblies and the freedom of assembly, the courts have been clear. The role of the police is to police the demonstration, is to ensure that anyone who is going to create a breach of peace will actually be dealt with by the police. The role of the police is not to prohibit, and in carrying out their constitutional mandate of maintaining law and order, that constitutional mandate doesn't include two things. It doesn't give them the right to prohibit assemblies and the freedom to assemble. That's number one. Number two, it doesn't give them the right to brutally arrest citizens.
But at last, but certainly not the least, you know, the police in Uganda have often relied on the Public Order Management Act to carry out actions. How do you react to their use of the Public Management Act?
The Public Order Management Act has been challenged in court as being unconstitutional, insofar as when the act gives the police power to prohibit assemblies, that has been regarded by the Constitutional Court as being
unconstitutional insofar as it limits the rights of citizens to express their opinions, number one, but also it limits the rights of citizens to exercise the right to assemble and to demonstrate. So the arguments, all arguments around the Public Order Management Act have been taken to court and the Constitutional Court in three Constitutional Court decisions. And the court has been very clear that, you know, so far as exercising the right to demonstrate peacefully and as long as you're unarmed, the police does not have the power to prohibit assemblies. And number two, even the criminal sanctions that are attached under the Public Order Management Act are also unconstitutional.
Bernard Undu is president of the Uganda Law Society. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Direct from Washington, the voice of America, VOA. In Mozambique, the director of the Center for Democracy and Development, or CDD, is expressing concern about plans by the government to postpone district elections in 2024. This after President Philippe Nyusi expressed doubt about the coming elections. The president's concerns come as the National Elections Commission said it does not have the financial resources to organize the polls. The president also announced the creation of a commission to assess the viability of district elections. But Adriano Novunga, director at CDD, says the president and his ruling Frelimo party must conform to the constitution, which he says provides for district elections to be administered in 2024. He also called on the authorities to respect the rights of citizens to participate in the country's democracy. For more about the concerns surrounding a possible postponement of district elections in 2024, as well as rumors that the president will seek a third term in office, I had a sit-down interview in the VOA studios here in Washington with Adriano Novunga.
No, we are deeply disappointed to the way that the current president is pushing for the postponement of the district-level elections.
Why are you disappointed? Because the postponement, some argue, is for a just cause.
The disappointment is because election is the opportunity for the people to speak, the possibility for the people to elect their leaders. Mm. There will be the general elections, but that would be the district level elections would give an opportunity for young people at the district level to exercise their agency by choosing their councillors, by choosing the administrator. And in so doing, this would increase local participation, it would increase transparency and accountability.
So why do you think that the reasons the government or perhaps the president is pushing for the postponement of the elections are not legitimate? Because supporters of his are saying they are quite legitimate and that the elections are not being cancelled, just this postponed.
This is path dependent. Since 1994, Frelimo has since been denying local people the possibility to participate in local democracies. Hmm. And this is an instrument of authoritarianism. Because if you look at the electoral map, it is evident that if people are given the chance to participate at the local level, there is a big chance that Frelimo dominance would be seriously weakened.
Talking about elections, there have been speculations that President Philippe Nyusi might seek a third term, unprecedented. Some argue if he goes ahead with it, that could undermine the constitution. Others are saying, well, it's just people saying it. He has not come out fully to say it. What's your response to that?
Well, people have been expecting President Nyusi to come up clear and solidly say he's not into the third term. The constitution is clear. Is two term in a life. You have done that, leave. Because remember, you are there today because someone has left. Imagine if that person has denied to leave, you wouldn't be there. So you have also to abide by the constitution because you have agreed to respect the Constitution of the Republic. And the Constitution is the biggest and the most important institution that we have. So a serving president to allow rumors to grow that he is tempting for third term and moving the way he has been moving. Let's take the example of not allowing people to a peaceful demonstration.
Well, for that, some people are saying that the police are there to enforce the law and to maintain law and order. Now, some people, they argue, want to create chaos, disaffection, undermine social cohesion, and create chaos in the society. So the police had to make sure that those who they deem as troublemakers are not allowed necessarily to create chaos and to protect the territorial integrity of Mozambique.
Quite the opposite. It has been 10 years that peaceful demonstration was denied. But after 10 years, the mayor of Maputo municipality, he gave a permission for young people to peacefully demonstrate in salutation to a rapper musician who died, who is someone who is much appreciated by the people. So it was a demonstration to celebrate life and legacy of an important musician.
Are you pleased with the current human rights situation in Mozambique? And if you are not, what is the next step forward in order to ensure or to encourage others to create the enabling space for human rights conditions to improve?
Mozambique is moving in a trajectory of the blocking the civic space. They have a draft law to close the civic space. And this comes after prominent human rights defenders, they have been beaten up, they have been abducted, and unfortunately, one of the prominent human rights defenders has paid with his life. So threat, harassment, use of legislative processes and judiciary to persecute human rights defenders is quite common in Mozambique today.
Adriano Nuvunga is the director of the Center for Democracy and Development, or CDD, in Mozambique. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Civil society and the Consumers Association of Malawi have rejected plans by the government to increase water tariffs by 52%. The groups are questioning the timing of the hike, saying it is insensitive in today's challenging economic conditions. They also expressed concern that the increase will have a bad effect on other essential goods and services. This after the government approved a proposal by five water boards to increase tariffs. The move was put on hold last year after sharp opposition from civil society and the Consumers Association of Malawi. In requesting the increase, the utility institutions contend that operational and production costs have significantly increased. The failure to increase tariffs, officials argue, could lead to the collapse of the utility companies. But critics say the increase will worsen cholera. For more about the opposition to the water tariff hike, I reach Sylvester Namiwa. He is the executive director of the Center for Democracy Economic Development Initiatives.
It is simply inconceivable that a government that has got the welfare of Malawians, especially vulnerable at heart, would at this material time accept any board to increase the cost of water. Because we are just coming from the devastating Cyclone Freddy that almost washed away all the alternative water sources. Now, if government intends to increase the tariff of water, it means we are condemning millions of Malawians to be using unprotected water sources because they cannot manage. They cannot manage because already there is a skyrocketing cost of living. The president should have used the 1 billion kwacha sent for grasses at his state residences meant for the loans, or 2 billion that has been set aside for his endless global trotting to subsidize the cost of water.
Prices of goods have gone up all over the world.
and the chemicals used to process water has also gone up. Don't you think that Malawians should pay realistic tariff based on how expensive things have gotten?
If you factor in how wasteful this government is, it doesn't make sense, because it's a total hypocrisy that the Malawians, they should tighten their belts when those people they elected, they put into office, they should loosen their own belts. There is a lot of wasteful in this government. Therefore, it does not make sense that the taxpayer should pay the price. It should start.
But Namiwa, in spite of the difficulties that Malawians face, the government has to run. International obligations would have to be met. You can't just be in a coup in Malawi and not go anywhere just because there are challenges, you know.
Just across here, our neighbor, Tanzania, we had late President Dr. Magufuli, who literally transformed the face of Tanzania without leaving Africa. This is the whole reason why we have got embassies and high commissioners out to the outside. They are there to represent the president in an event that he does not want to travel or has been constrained to travel. Some of these events the president goes to attend, they are very petty. They have nothing to do with the current situation we are facing. In fact,
are you saying the president's trip to the United Kingdom to witness the swearing in of King Charles is bad for Malawi? Is that what you're saying?
Highly insensitive, because as the president is leaving the country, the economy is on its knees. There is literally no fuel in Malawi. Any leader that cares about the plight of the people, it is not the right time to leave the country. Suffice to say that we have got the whole high commissioner in London who could have helped represent the president there. Why we should be finding or banging heads, should be looking for solutions to end the national crisis. Now, look here. We are coming from a situation where we don't have forex. This is why we have got the long queues of fuel. At the same time, we have got intermittent power supply. How do you expect anything to work in the kind of scenario? And surprising enough, the president is happy, hoping from one thing to another, doing this as nothing, spending the very same scarce forex that should have been used or spared to buy or to pay for the fuel.
Namiwa, some people are saying you will accuse the government and criticize the government no matter the decision the government takes. And so people should not even take you serious. How do you respond to some of your critics who say that?
That's the beauty of democracy. People are entitled to their own opinions, but Malawians are their own witnesses. Malawians are their own witnesses. We have got, for the first time, a leader that doesn't care about the plight of Malawians. So if those people, they have got positive stories about this country, let them tell their stories, because we represent the people. Because there's no way I can be applauding, I can be clapping hands for a leader when actually Malawians are crying. We speak for the vulnerable. We speak for the ordinary Malawian, the voter. These people are happy because they are benefiting from this system. You see, those people that benefit from a 40 system, they don't see that system to be 40 because they are benefiting. Those people accusing me of being harsh or being critical to the president, they are the beneficiaries of the plight of Malawians.
Sylvester Namiwa is the executive director of the Center for Democracy Economic Development Initiatives. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, he's a freshly graduated medical student from the University of Cape Coast in Ghana's Central Region,
who took away 16 out of the 22 awards at the school's 55th congregation. Among the awards Dr. Nathaniel Ni and T.A. Kuju won include the top prize in medical biochemistry, physiology, microbiology, community medicine, chemical pathology, and pharmacology. He was also judged to be the best clinical student, best graduating preclinical student, overall performance, best student in family medicine and molecular medicine with certificate awards. Dr. Kuju was recently honored by the Gamanche, the King and Overlord of Accra, for his academic exploits at a ceremony in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. To learn more about his academic exploits, his motivation and prospect as a newly minted physician, I reached Dr. Nathaniel Ni Antie Kuju.
Yeah, so concerning the awards, I must say it was a surreal experience to actually get 16 awards on the day of the graduation. I was very excited, quite overwhelmed with emotions. My family, everyone was so happy. My mom, my dad. I think with the videos that were circulating, you can see my mom moving all around, so excited. My dad was at the back, waving his hands all over. My brother was moving up and down with the bouquet of flowers. So it was a really exciting feeling. Everyone was so happy. And personally, I was so happy to be able to make them happy on that occasion.
Did you anticipate the kind of attention and popularity that your academic exploit brought to you?
No, honestly, no. To be honest, I wasn't expecting it to be that way. Because I think the last year, another one of our students had 15 awards. So I've got 16 awards, and the publicity that it has got wasn't something that I was expecting. Honestly, I must be honest, I didn't think it would go this far. I'm just grateful to God for how things have turned out.
So tell me, Ni, what was your motivation?
Yes, I personally believe that in every environment you are in, you need to strive to give off your best, give up the best of yourself. So you shouldn't settle for anything more other than the best. So as you are going through the years, I always make sure that I give off my best and to make sure that you have the lot of academic discipline, because with the medicine program, like a lot of academic discipline is needed because of the volume of stuff that you need to know within a short period of time. And there's a lot of attention on you, both from your colleagues, both from your lecturers as well. So that one becomes an extra motivation because, you know, all eyes are sort of on you and you don't want to disappoint anyone. Yeah.
Now you have graduated. Where are you working now and what is the next steps forward, if I may ask you?
Yeah, so I'm currently working in Accra, State 7 Hospital, GPS. The next step for me is, so I'm currently doing my house job there, which will be for a year, then I'll move on to another place to do another year. So that will complete 2 years of internship. As soon as I'm done, I'm planning to move into a specialty, preferably neurology, because I have the dream of setting up a stroke unit in my country, Ghana, which is designed and dedicated towards management of stroke patients, especially to help avoid some of the complications that they suffer from, which sometimes contributes to the mortality associated with stroke. Yeah.
Have you spoken to any mentors or anybody who can help you?
Yeah, so I've spoken to a number of specialists, not necessarily from the field of neurology. I'm yet to contact FSC from the field of neurology because you don't have a lot of them in the country at the moment. But I've spoken to other junior colleagues, specialists, and consultants about this, and they've advised me appropriately on what steps to take as to get there.
So for those who will be listening to you around the world, in Ghana, Africa, and the rest of the world, what would be your message to them?
Yes, so I would like to say that when you have a dream, you should always focus on the dream. You should not be too comfortable in the course of achieving the dream. So let me just use the example. I think you want to move from a point A to C. You don't say that because you are B, and you are so comfortable, you are doing so well at, you shouldn't lose focus of the fact that your end goal was to get to the point C. So you should always make sure that you have the dream in mind, your focus is on the dream, and you should strive to make sure that you achieve the dream that you set out at the start of your journey.
Dr. Nathaniel Ni Antiekujo is a freshly graduated medical student from the University of Cape Coast. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
Has social media improved your life, or is it more of a distraction? We'd love to hear from you. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076. The number again, plus one, 202-258-3076. Can't wait to hear from you.
Gibson Kawago is the founder of Waga, a Tanzanian tech startup focused on addressing energy shortages in the East African nation. He is now on a tour of the U.S., where he's engaging with entrepreneurs, leaders, and members of the diaspora on how he can grow his business across Africa. Kawago is among the entrepreneurs that met and showcased his product to Vice President Kamala Harris during her recent visit to the continent, where she hailed young people for their innovation. My colleague Mike Hove sat down with Kawago to learn more about his U.S. trip and how his company Waga is addressing energy shortages in Africa.
I came here to the United States. I'm one among the 17 young leaders for Sustainable Development Goals, where I help Tanzanian youths to make sure they understand about the SDGs and to help them on how they can identify different problems in the society and use them as opportunities to come up with solutions to tackle them and so that we can create jobs. I was recognized by the UN last year, and I'll be working with them for a period of 2 years. And this time, we came for a retreat. Mm-hmm. And we also came for the ECOSOC Forum, Economic and Social Council. So after the meeting, then I organized together with Engineer Walter Minja and Peter Ligate, the meet and greet. You know, the main target of this meet and greet is to meet different specialists in the battery sector.
Talk to us about how you are addressing Tanzania's energy shortages.
Yeah, so most of the times we always look to solve problems, but sometimes the solutions that we use create other problems. For example, fighting the problem for lighting, people who use kerosene lamps, they solve the lighting problem and create another problem, releasing carbon dioxide. So at Waga, we looked at it in a different way. Like, we decided to look at how different people in Tanzania are poorly disposing electric waste and electronic waste. Then we looked at how we can transform the waste into energy. We have youth and women battery collectors who collect the laptop batteries, which are trashed in different places, and we buy from them so that we can incentivize them and make sure that we create decent jobs. Then we process those batteries. Then we create lithium-ion power packs. Now, these power packs have different functions. A power pack can power an electric scooter. Then coming to the lighting and powering solution, in most of the places in Tanzania, still they don't have access to the grid. What we have done, we have created portable power packs that people in rural places, they can install in the house. They can put solar panels on the top of the roof. Then they can do a wiring and the power pack can be recharged. Then what they can do, they can watch televisions, they can charge mobile phones, they can power everything in-house from the power pack.
What other countries are you looking to expand operations to?
We were looking towards expanding our works to Congo, to Sudan, to Somalia, to Kenya in some of the places, and to Malawi, because we found there are so many communities that still need clean energy, and there's still a room for that. So as far as we have started working in Tanzania, we are now looking at how we can expand to different African countries so that we can make Africa great again.
Gibson Kawago is the founder of Waga, a Tanzanian tech startup. He spoke with my colleague Mike Hove from here in Washington. A new report by Freedom House indicates that Tunisia experienced over the past year the third largest decline in press freedom of any country as a result of the actions of the elected president. Kais Saied has continued to consolidate power by formally dissolving the parliament and creating a new constitution and dismantled legislative and judicial checks on the executive branch. For viewer Noura Hafaid depicted a gloomy picture on the ground.
The decline in press freedom in Tunisia came as a result of decision of Tunisian President Kais Saied 2 years ago to consolidate his power with the reforms of the three branches of government. It was followed by issuing a decree last September which criminalized electronic publishing and rolling back media freedoms gained after 2011. The campaign of arrests in Tunisia has expanded in a recent month to include, in addition to political figure, the director of the private Mosaic Radio, Nordine Boutar, his interrogation by security agents over the radio's editorial has sparked condemnation by Tunisian journalists. Mehdi Al-Jalassi is a member of the Tunisian Journalist Syndicate. He highlighted the threats that have become an obstacle to the practitioners of the profession.
Since July 25, 2021, the issue of monopolizing power by President Kais Saied and gathering all powers in his hands contributed to tightening the margins of freedom and opinion trials of journalists, activists, and politicians. All of this is what Tunisia is going through due to the political change and due to exceptional measures. The decrees issued by the president are all repressive and aim to crack down on freedom of opinion and expression.
In response, the Higher Independent Authority for Audiovisual Communication, HICA, requested that competent authorities ensure the editorial independence of media institutions and reject any interference in their choices outside the frameworks regulated by law. Hisham Al-Sanusi is a member of the HICA.
Since 2014, there was supposed to be a final law for the HICA to prevent state interference in the press. However, due to the change took place on July 25 through Kais Saied, this law has not been implemented. And as a member of the Council of Higher Independent Authority for Audiovisual Commission, we have issued many statements denouncing the manipulation of the state institutions, especially those that perpetuate the democratic transition.
Presidential Decree 54 imposes prison sentences of up to 6 years and a fine up to $20,000 for violating its provision for fighting IT and telecom crimes. Article 3 states that the Penal Code and the Code of Criminal Procedures continue to apply to stated crimes in the new law and may allow for even harsher punishments. Tunisian journalist Fares Jami, a newly graduated journalist and an active member of the Syndicate of Journalists, explains the effect of the decree on press freedom.
Journalists become fearful of being sanctioned under the basis of this decree, and this is considered as a break on the freedom of the press and expression. The arrest of Nordine Boutar and other journalists under Decree 54 is considered as a serious threat for all journalists and also for the freedom of expression in Tunisia.
Freedom of the press is not only threatened by state authorities, but according to Amir bin Mohammed Abdul Wahab, it is also threatened by disinformation that is posted on some social media platforms.
Today, we're living in the reality of digital space, so the problem has become a threat to the value and quality of journalistic work. Social media become a threat to professional ethics and guidance to public opinion and the emergence of professionality that have nothing to do with the professional of journalism and media, which have become competing with the biggest media professional and threatening the value of journalistic work.
Freedom of opinion, expression, press and media was one of the most important gains of the 2011 Jasmine Revolution. However, the progress is on the brinks of collapse and journalists are sounding the alarm as they are subjected to arrests, harassment and violations of their freedoms. For Voice of America, I'm Noura Faiv from Tunisia.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
My name is Divine Tembeng Mba from Pretoria in South Africa, and you are listening to Nightline Africa from the Voice of America with Peter Clothe. Stay tuned and don't change the dial.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Hove, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the tortoise said that it always travels with its musical instrument in case it meets other musicians. I'm your host, Peter Clothe, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.